From listener-supported Capital Public Radio, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Later in the program, we'll go to Fresno for the start of the six-day funeral of General Vang Pao, leader of the Hmong people in America. Also, California has a nursing shortage and unemployment is high, so why is it some nursing school graduates are still looking for work? But first, the protests in Egypt. We have eyewitness testimony and expert reaction. In a couple of minutes, you'll hear from a local imam who's from Egypt and a UC Davis historian who's done research there. But we start with a Sacramento student who just returned this week from Cairo. He was in Tahrir Square, the center of this week's dramatic events. Taylor Budwich, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You were evacuated from Egypt on Monday, correct?
Correct. I was evacuated by the U.S. Embassy on Monday.
So you left before the violence really picked up in Tahrir Square.
Right. I mean, I was there Friday night on the January 28th is when I think the protests first got violent, and that was when the military was first called in. So I was in the square when the military entered with their tanks and armored vehicles.
And why did you go to the square?
In the morning, we all knew that the protests were going to get very large on that Friday, and I wanted to observe them being created, and I planned on getting out of there in the early afternoon to avoid any threat. And however, the police locked down all the streets, and there was no taxis available, so I ended up getting stuck, and I was able to seek refuge in a hostel that overlooked the square.
You took a lot of photographs of what you saw, and they're online, and we're putting some of them on our webpage, capradio.org/insight. It looks like you got overhead views of soldiers or maybe police. I'm not sure.
It was the police officers that I observed mostly, because the military didn't come in until about 11:30 p.m. So the clash between the protesters and the police officers started around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and the protesters finally broke in and took control of the square around 7 o'clock in the evening.
Now, there are a lot of people in the square, but is there any way to sum up who these people were? Did you get an overwhelming impression of the kind of people who were in the square?
Yes. I mean, after speaking with a lot of people there, these are people that love their country and want the best for their country, and they've kind of found themselves put up against a wall, and the only way to seek any sort of freedom or equality or come out of poverty is to fight back, and that's what it looks like is happening right now.
Taylor Budwich is a student from Sacramento. He's a student at the American University in Cairo, but clearly not right now. He was evacuated from Egypt earlier this week, and he witnessed protests in Cairo late last week and at the weekend. Let's bring into our discussion Imam Mohammed Abdulaziz, who's a religious leader of the Salam Islamic Center in Sacramento. He's been on our program before. He was born and raised in Egypt. Imam Aziz, welcome back.
It's always a pleasure, Jeffrey.
What do you feel and what do you think when you watch the events that have been happening recently in Cairo, starting with what appeared to be the jubilation of protesters trying to seek the ouster of President Mubarak, then the violence setting in?
Right. This is really very, very personal for me. I mean, my mother is still there right now. I have cousins who are at Tahrir Square. So many childhood friends are there. And I keep making phone calls every day. The media portrays this sometimes. I mean, most media outlets have done a wonderful job so far. But some people are saying this is mayhem. This is a civil war. It is nothing like that. These are, just like I couldn't agree more with Taylor. These are people who are struggling for freedom and democracy that are being fought and oppressed by their government and being crushed by the security forces of their government, sometimes in wearing, plain clothes, sometimes, wearing their police uniforms, whatever it is. It is not driven by Islamists. It is not driven by political parties. It is not driven by ideology. It is the average people just spontaneously took to the streets in order to make a statement about the situation in Egypt.
Given the track record, the human rights track record of the Mubarak government, it presumably must take some courage for people to protest publicly against his regime.
It takes either courage or desperation. When you're pushed to the limit and you're unable to provide for your family and all of your rights are taken away, there's no due process, there's no rule of law, corruption is rampant, police has just unbelievable authority. They decide, you know, what kind of person is selected to become a faculty member of universities. They decide on everything, who takes this job and who takes that job, who enters into the country and who leaves the country. So people faced with this kind of repression, they just had to take it to the street. But to the streets, what I have been very proud of is that they chose to be peaceful, to be civilized, to clean the streets, to portray the most beautiful image of Egypt. And, you know, it really comforts me greatly to see that.
Imam Aziz. And our third guest is Keith David Wattenpaugh. He's an historian and associate professor of modern Islam, human rights and peace at UC Davis. And he's lived and conducted research in many countries in the Middle East, including Egypt. Keith, welcome back to Insight.
Thank you.
You have studied Egypt and the region. What do you make of the reaction of the Mubarak government so far to the protesters? Has he reacted as in the way you expected?
Well, he's someone who really wants to hold on to power, and I think that as these protests have continued and have gone on, and I think we've really seen the Egyptian people mounting a really remarkable opposition to his government. I'm afraid that we're seeing the Egyptian military beginning to circle the wagons and will eventually push Mubarak aside, but I think that we'll see the persistence of a military dictatorship in Egypt.
We've heard many times in news reports that the military in Egypt is a very important institution in the country. Why is that? What does it mean?
Well, the military in Egypt is the most important institution in the country. It holds the reins of power. Egypt has been ruled by a military dictatorship since 1952. And what I really see happening is that they're willing to sacrifice Mubarak, but we're seeing the placement of Omar Suleiman, an ex-military man. The prime minister is an ex-military man. And the chief of staff of the army and the new interior ministry are all drawn from the Egyptian military. And that despite the popular protests and the attempt to bring democracy to Egypt, that it will continue to be ruled by the military.
So you're saying that even if Mubarak does leave office, there could be more of the same or maybe even worse?
I don't think it's going to necessarily be worse, but I think it'll be more of the same. And I'm really afraid that the Egyptian people who really are demanding more and deserve more are going to be disappointed, and that this revolution will fade, and it will be the Egyptian military will persist as the dominant power in Egyptian society.
Imam Aziz, your thoughts on the role of the Egyptian military and what you think they are going to do, as far as you can tell.
Right. I mean, I agree with the Professor Wattenpaugh's overall assessment. I disagree with his prediction of the future. I think the big factor that we should not ignore is the millions of people on the streets. Definitely the military will try to keep power in its territory, but I don't think that the Egyptian people will allow that simply because they have tasted finally what freedom means, and they have taken to the streets, and they have been able to achieve some results through that. My prediction is that eventually, under mounting international pressure and pressure within the Egyptian streets, Mubarak will have to be either nudged or he'll step down on his own. An interim government will be in place for a few. The military will have a role in that government. It could be a bigger role, but I don't think that it'll control that future government of Egypt.
Taylor Budowich, when you were in Cairo at Tahrir Square and that vicinity, what were your impressions of both the military and the Egyptian police?
Well, and that's one thing that might lend evidence to support the professor's hypothesis of the future, is when the military entered the square, the people rejoiced. They climbed on top of the tanks, and they see the military as their own, whereas the police are their enemies. And going forward, if there's any sort of void that's created, it's going to be filled in part by the military, like the professor was saying. So at this point, there's such a strong bond, I feel, between the military and the people, and I watched it unfold in front of my eyes. So at this point, going forward, I don't see the military losing any strength in the government.
What did you think when you saw the escalation and the violence as this week went on? You had by that time left Egypt.
It's very saddening because, I mean, I'm not a tourist there anymore. I have a connection to the region, to the country, and to the people, and I have a lot of friends there now that I have had to leave behind that are in the thick of things now. So it's saddening for me.
You're a political science student, right?
Correct.
Yeah. And as I understand, you actually talked with Imam Aziz before you went to Egypt.
I did. Ironically enough, it was funny coming and meeting him again today. When I went to Egypt originally, it was my first time out of the country. So I wanted to have some sort of bearing onto what I was getting myself into. And luckily, the Imam was able to provide some insight.
Imam Aziz, for Americans who've never been to Egypt, what would you like to say to them that you think they may have picked up about Egypt or the Egyptian people that you think is wrong and that is important for people to know?
The word stability is being hurled right and left. You know, Egypt was a stable country. You know, there's this veneer of welcoming and hospitable attitude towards tourists in general, because this is a multi-billion dollar industry. It's one of the lifelines of the regime. So Westerners, they go to Egypt, they see nothing but good, hospitable attitude from the tourism structure over there. Underneath, though, there is absolute public discontent with the government. You know, the average Egyptian earns probably about $60 a month. Most people live in poverty. 30% of the population is uneducated. And you know, like I said, there's no due process. There's no rule of law. No separation of powers. People can be arrested incommunicado for months, and their parents and families don't know where they are. A protesting organization, the creation of political parties, all of these things are not allowed in Egypt. Westerners need to know what is driving this is not necessarily people who want to put food on the table, but rather people who are actually politically savvy, who want to change their country, who want freedom, and they deserve our support in the West.
Keith Wadenbaum of UC Davis, what are the prospects, if any, of the Muslim Brotherhood that we hear a lot about taking power, or groups associated with them taking power?
Taking power is unlikely, but the United States government and others have made it clear that they expect that the Muslim Brotherhood should be allowed to participate in any national unity government. And the Muslim Brotherhood represents an important feature of Egyptian society, and they have a right to participate. But our polling data and our understanding of Egypt seems to suggest that the Muslim Brotherhood in a democratic setting wouldn't receive an overwhelming amount of votes, and in fact would be only part or have to go into coalition with other governments to assist in rule. So this has been hyped, especially by the far right-wing media in the United States, that this is a Muslim Brotherhood-backed revolt, and I think that's really far from the truth.
We're talking about what's going on in Egypt. My guests are Taylor Budowich, who's a political science student from Sacramento. He's enrolled at the American University in Cairo but was evacuated earlier this week. Keith Wadenbaum is a historian and associate professor of modern Islam, human rights, and peace at UC Davis. And Imam Muhammad Abdul Aziz is religious leader of the Salam Islamic Center in Sacramento. Taylor, you, when you were in Egypt, you're obviously not a representative of the American government, but did people in Egypt say to you what they hoped the United States would do or not do? Because the United States has a close relationship at a government level with the Egyptian government, gives them money and so on, and you would think has some influence.
The U.S. government obviously has influence in the region. However, I feel the sentiment has changed, maybe not as drastic as that's been portrayed on some of the news channels. For the most part, Egyptians love Americans, and I've always had a very positive reaction when I was there. Of course, when the tear gas canisters that are being fired are stamped with "Made in the USA," there's going to be a change in sentiment, and that has been evident.
Those were presumably provided by the American government to the Egyptian government.
Correct. Yes. And it's exactly, and that's the irony, I think, behind it, because though there might be a lot of positive influence and aid going there, there looks to be some negative as well.
Imam Aziz, what would you like to see the U.S. government do or not do with regard to what's going on in Egypt?
I agree with Taylor. Most Egyptians really have a high, you know, very respectable views of most Americans. They might have an issue with the American government. What I think that Egyptians expect America to do is to not interfere negatively to the favor of the regime. This uprising came from the streets, driven by the masses of Egypt. They're not waiting for anyone to help them. They're not interested in the West helping them. They're just asking America to just keep a hands-off policy. If America were to interfere, it can use its influence to nudge Mubarak, but that's all they want.
What about America's financial aid to Egypt? Would you support withholding that for now?
But again, the average Egyptian thinks that most of that is going into the regime anyway. A big chunk of it is going to the military, and the rest is going into the pockets of the regime's entourage. The average Egyptian doesn't get anything out of that anyway. So, you know, if that is the reason why the Mubarak regime is still in power, everyone would say, you know what, we don't want it anymore.
And Keith Wadenpaugh, I'm guessing there's a risk anyway for the United States in whatever it does, because it could be seen as leaning on an internal dispute, and that could embolden people on the Mubarak side.
Well, I think that it's unfortunate that the president didn't come out more strongly in favor of the protests originally, but I think that the Obama administration has really moved in the right direction, saying that Mubarak has to go, but also helping the Egyptians outline a transitional period that really looks to creating a national salvation government that will be empowered to write a new constitution and so on. I'm afraid that the Obama administration is further along in this process than the Egyptian administration is, and that they are really not listening to our government at the moment.
But isn't there a risk if President Obama came out more strongly in favor of the protesters, that could give President Mubarak a reason to say, well, this is a foreign conspiracy,
which he's saying anyway. Omar Suleiman has said that there are foreign elements that are backing the protesters, and this is just not true. But I think at this point, we need to be on the right side of this, and it's fairly clear how this is going to turn out. And we have to use this as an opportunity to reset our relationship with the peoples of the Middle East, that we are not on the sides of dictators, we are on the sides of human rights.
Imam Aziz, the people of Egypt, do they want what you think American people think they want? In other words, do they want the kind of society that Americans call democratic?
I'll tell you one thing. Like I said, I'm on the phone every day, numerous times. My phone bill will balloon this month. With friends and family in Tahrir Square. And the one thing that I keep asking them, what is the influence of the Muslim Brotherhood on these protests? And everyone says less than 5%. They're there and they're supporting us, but they're not exercising any influence. I ask about the presence of Christians. You know, they're there. Cops are there. Soccer players, singers, writers, you know, thinkers, all kinds of people, you know, liberals, socialists. What all of them agree upon is the establishment of a democratic society where people can represent themselves, that people can select their own leaders. And I think that's what most of us want. You know, they cherish these same values. We want a representative government. We want accountability. We want better jobs, a better standard of living, and eventually better relations with the entire world, a relationship with the U.S. that is based on respect and mutual interest and not influence that favors one side.
And finally, Taylor Budowicz, do you plan to go back to Egypt? And if so, when?
Well, it's an unfortunate circumstance for me because I'm just a student trying to complete my education, and now I'm 21 years old and haven't finished my sophomore year in college yet. This would have been my last semester of so. So I'm very conflicted at this point, though I have always enjoyed my experience there, and it's been unparalleled to anything that I would experience here. I feel that it might be best if I complete the remainder of my education in the United States, and going forward, decide when I will return to Egypt.
Well, thank you all so much. Again, some of Taylor's photographs are on our webpage, capradio.org/insight. In the meantime, thank you to our three guests, Keith Wadenpaugh, historian, associate professor of modern Islam, human rights and peace at UC Davis. He's, among other places, done research and lived in Egypt. Imam Mohammed Abdulaziz, religious leader of the Salam Islamic Center in Sacramento. He was born and raised in Egypt. And Taylor Budowicz, student from Sacramento, just returned from Egypt, where he was studying at the American University in Cairo. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
And this is Insight on listener-supported Capital Public Radio. When we come back, we'll go to Fresno for the start of the six-day funeral of General Vang Pao. Insight from listener-supported Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. We'll go to Fresno a little later in the program. We're having problems reaching Stephen Maganini, the Sacramento Bee reporter, who's in Fresno covering the start of the six-day funeral of General Vang Pao. In the meantime, California has a nursing shortage and unemployment is high. So why is it that some nursing school graduates are still looking for work? Joining us to discuss this is Monica Small, who's Regional Director of Clinical Workforce Development at Sutter Health, and also two top people at local nursing programs. But we'll start with Monica Small at Sutter Health. Monica, thanks for joining us.
I'm glad to be here.
Is there actually a nursing shortage?
Right now, there's a temporary. We've done very, very well addressing the shortage that started in about 2000. But right now,
Nursing shortage. You were telling us about how much of a nursing shortage there actually is.
Right now, it's very, very temporary because what's happened in the region, as well as statewide and nationwide, is that a lot of the nurses we thought were going to be retiring have stayed on, and a lot of nurses have ended up going part-time. And so right now, it's a very, very temporary shortage. But we do anticipate that starting in about 2012, there's going to be a very real shortage.
And why do you say it's temporary?
Because we've done a good job filling the positions, like through our public and private partnership with Los Rios. We've done a good job, but we also know there's going to be more retirements coming up, and we're not going to be able to keep up.
And have these retirements been postponed because of the economy, as far
yes.
as you can tell?
Yes.
I see.
Yes.
Monica Small of Sutter Health. Tanya Altman is Assistant Director of the Sacramento State Nursing Department, and Holly Devon is Associate Professor of the Betty Irene Moore School of Nursing at UC Davis. Welcome both.
Thank you very much.
Tanya, how much interest is there in learning how to be a nurse?
Oh, our program has been impacted for years and years, and I think all the regional nursing programs are impacted. We admit 80 students a semester, and we have 300 to 400 applicants a semester. And these are qualified applicants. They're people that are very interested in doing nursing. And we're going to be needing them, as Monica said, with the economy right now. We've got nurses that should have retired that are staying at the bedside. We've got nurses that are doing part-time or picking up extra hours because they're worried about the economy or their spouses have been laid off. And so it's a really good profession. We know we're going to need nurses. We've got an aging population. People are living longer with more and more chronic diseases. So it's a need, a great need.
You said that you're getting hundreds of qualified applicants, more than you can accept, I guess.
Absolutely, more than we can accept.
Yeah. Holly, what about at UC Davis?
Yes, I concur. I have a little bit of a different perspective on the nursing shortage. I do think there is a nursing shortage, but right now I think there's a shortage of positions. So because of the recession, as we've discussed already, there are nurses remaining in the job market who may have chosen to retire or to work part-time. Many of our students have become the primary breadwinners for their families because their spouses have lost jobs. So I think there's freezes in some institutions. Also, the recession means patients are not seeking care. They may be seeking care for emergencies, going to the emergency department. But for chronic problems, they're not, and therefore revenue is down at many institutions, and so they have just resorted to furloughs or freezes. So nurses are needed for sure.
So a lot of factors here all pointing at the same direction, and it seems that the economy is involved in most of
yes.
these factors. But that suggests then that once the economy improves, that and these factors diminish, that there will be more open positions for nurses and not necessarily enough qualified nurses. Is that fair to say?
Undoubtedly. It's absolutely. And that's why our new school, is preparing leaders and future faculty. We strategically opened with graduate programs only as we build up in order to provide for more faculty. That's another issue besides
yes.
the nursing shortage is, as Tanya said, we're turning away very well-qualified students, and that's unfortunate because we don't have a sufficient number of faculty.
Can you give us some idea of the volume of qualified applicants for your school at UC Davis? It's okay if you don't have it.
Oh, no, I know it. Yeah, it's hundreds. And currently we have 33 positions, 25 master's positions, and 8 PhD. So, you know, currently we have 5 full-time faculty and 3 part-timers. We're building our faculty as well right now through our launch period. So we have a goal of having about 450 positions for students in the next 5 years. It's it's a laudable goal and it's a challenge. We hope to get there because we know we're turning away thousands. In California, I think we turned away about 20 or 25,000 qualified applicants last year alone.
Wow.
Yeah.
And Tanya, what are these people doing otherwise? Do you know?
Some of them are just keeping doing prerequisite courses. Some of them are trying other health science courses and continuing to try to get into the nursing program. The GPA we admit is in the high threes, 3.7, 3.8, just to get into our program.
Yeah. And we're talking about supply and demand in the nursing profession. My guests are representatives of two local nursing programs. Tanya Altman is Assistant Director of the Sacramento State Nursing Department, and Holly Devon is Associate Professor of the Betty Irene Moore School of Nursing at UC Davis, and Monica Small is with Sutter Health. Monica Small, when you listen to our two people from universities who train nurses, what they're describing about having to turn away all these qualified applicants, what goes through the minds of people at the hospital end?
Well, it's just very, very frustrating, and that's why we've had the opportunity at Sutter Health to be able to have our partnership with Los Rios, which has been wonderful, so that we've been able to add on another 50, 55 students every semester besides the 30 or 33 that the main campus at Sac City is able to. So it's very, very frustrating because we know on our demand side, we know we have the need. We also know it's going to start getting worse. And we just, you know, that's why the public and private partnership is just so reaching out and helping serve our community.
Well, what will happen down the line as the economy improves, there aren't enough new nurses coming into the system. What is that going to mean at the hospital end?
Well, in the short term, they can rely on having, like, you know, registry nurses or travelers or, you know, positions like that. But that's a stopgap measure. We just have to keep, you know, working. And when we bring in our new graduates, we need to be able to give them a very good experience because we want to make sure that the ones that we get, that we keep them. We want to slow down the turnover because of the expenses with that. But we want our nurses to be qualified to be able to give that safe patient care. So we want to invest in them on the front end because we've got to be able to keep the ones that we get because the supply and demand is going to start being, it's going to be out of balance again.
Well, and separate from any given hospital's desire to have enough qualified nurses there to provide care, state law also has a say in this matter that there are mandated ratios
yes.
of nurses to patients.
Yes.
Is there a problem? Are we heading towards a problem in that respect too?
Well, we have always made that a priority, and sometimes often exceed those ratios with the way we're staffing. But you always have to keep that in mind, and you have to have that target. But more importantly, you just want to make sure we're providing that safe quality care that we're just doing the best we can. That's why it's going to be so important to help support the schools, and it's so important that we do take care of those new graduates that we get.
Tanya Altman, why do you think so many qualified people are applying to be nurses? I mean, is this normal to have that many people applying, or has something changed?
It's ebbed and flowed over the years, but nursing for the last number of years has been impacted, what we call when we've got too many applicants for the program. We've tried over the years to adjust with different types of programs, accelerated second bachelor's programs, entry-level master's programs, trying to get them. We've backed off a little bit right now because of the local just kind of slowdown of that nursing shortage in the Sacramento region, but it's a really good profession. It gives you good sense of well-being when you do a good job as a nurse. It has really good long-term effects that we can be helping, and it's a good career choice.
If there's this building pent-up demand for more younger qualified nurses, and you're getting all these hundreds of people applying who are qualified, is there no way to expand your program so that you can take more of those applicants in?
There's ways to expand, and we are looking at some of them. The nice thing with Sacramento State is we just got a new building, which will allow us to grow our program. Two things, again, the economy is a huge one because the university is limited on how many faculty they can employ. They can't put out requisitions for new faculty when there's an economy problem, getting the equipment and stuff with more and more students, because it is a very costly program to run. You have to have the supplies to teach the students to do injection. You can't just take them to a hospital and say, here's a needle, shove it in, just to be a little bit silly on it. But there's also a faculty shortage. UC Davis is doing their best to get us some faculty, but if you don't have qualified teachers, you know, and again, the economy plays into that a little bit because as a bedside nurse, you're making a lot more money than most faculty.
Because, Holly, part of UC Davis's role in this, along with other UC nursing schools, I suppose, is in part to train PhDs to be faculty members.
Yes, mm-hmm. Exactly. And we were very fortunate. We launched with an extraordinarily large donation from the Gordon and Betty Irene Moore Foundation to start the school.
That was the founder of Intel, wasn't it?
Yes, he was. And they have the foundation has a big interest in healthcare. And so they recognized that one way to for us to get well-qualified candidates to train to put in academic positions is to be able to fund them. It's very hard for people, especially in an economy like this, to leave their jobs to come and study full-time. So the Moore Foundation has provided funding for our students. We still can't admit any more because of us trying to build our faculty as well. So we do want to increase the capacity of our school, and we hope to do that very quickly.
And for both you, Holly, and Tanya, how has the nursing profession changed, and how has the education of that profession changed? Tanya?
Nursing has changed because it's become a lot more complex and complicated. Things that diseases that used to kill people, now they survive with it, plus they get a second disease on top of it, and a third disease and a fourth disease.
Which means more nursing care.
More nursing care and more complicated type of nursing care. As far as education, we've improved leaps and bounds in what we can do now with the human patient simulators. It is so phenomenal where we can actually have students running a cardiac arrest. And if the patient dies, we reboot, we review, students learn what they did wrong, what they can do better. You never want to have a student running a cardiac arrest on a human being. But with the simulators, we can simulate these things. We can get them involved in really complex medical issues where they're in charge. It used to be that you couldn't teach that. Students had to graduate as a nurse and then learn it on the job and hopefully do it right. Now we've just done leaps and bounds in how well we can educate our nurses.
Holly, does that mean that different people should be applying for it nowadays than, say, did 20 years ago? It's a different kind of person required to be a nurse.
Well, it is definitely. Healthcare demands are so much more complex that it demands a higher level of education and training. You know, the baby boomers just started retiring this month. So because of our advances in technology, we have been able to save lives. But now we have a lot of aging people in our community who have a large number of chronic diseases who need constant care. So that makes it very challenging. So yes, the answer is, in many cases, the education is difficult, it's arduous, but I love nursing. I got into nursing because I believe it's the greatest profession in the world. And that kind of relates to your question that you asked Tanya a while ago, was has it changed and are we attracting new people? It has changed. It is more challenging than it was for me when I graduated from college in the 70s. But it's a fantastic profession to support people's wellness.
And finally, Monica Small, should patients be concerned about this supply and demand problem now and more so in the future for nursing?
Well, I think we're all concerned, and that's why we're all making sure that we're providing, that we're doing what we can to support more people going into nursing. We certainly don't want patients to be afraid. We all are going to be patients someday, that's mm-hmm. for sure. So they need to be confident in knowing that there's a lot of people in this community that are aware of this, that are working on it, that are committed to making sure that we are providing care, safe quality care to the members of our community.
Well, thank you all so much. That was Monica Small, Regional Director of Clinical Workforce Development at Sutter Health. Tanya Altman is Assistant Director of the Sacramento State Nursing Department, and Holly Devon is Associate Professor of the Betty Irene Moore School of Nursing at UC Davis. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
And you're listening to Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. This is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. The six-day funeral of the leader of the Hmong people starts this morning in Fresno. General Vang Pao was a veteran of the Vietnam War. Joining us is reporter Stephen Maganini of the Sacramento Bee, who's in Fresno to cover the start of the funeral. He joins us by phone. Stephen Maganini, welcome back to Insight.
Thank you very much.
I read in your report this morning that some 60,000 Hmong people are expected to pay their respects to Vang Pao over the next 6 days. That's pretty astonishing. What is his significance to the Hmong people?
Well, he is seen as the liberator, as the trailblazer. He has been called the Hmong George Washington. He's been called the Hmong Moses for taking them to the promised land out of Laos. He has been compared to Nelson Mandela, and more importantly, he is seen as sort of the parent, the father and mother of his people. He has been the unifying force, and he has been a force of consistency for the Hmong for decades.
Why is this 6 day funeral happening in Fresno? Is that where he lived at the end of his life?
Well, he lived in Westminster, but the first real Hmong enclave in the United States was in Fresno, and so that is why it's being held here. It's also the halfway point between Southern California and Sacramento, which has a giant Hmong population as well.
Can you tell us, summarize his war record in the Vietnam War? He fought on the U.S. side.
He was recruited by the CIA in about 1961 to form a guerrilla army, to fight the communists.
And there's a lot of noise behind you. Are you in the vicinity of the funeral?
Excuse me?
We can hear a lot of noise behind you. Are you in the vicinity of the funeral?
Absolutely. The bagpipers have just gone through, and the coffin is being brought into the convention hall. Now there's a full military band inside, and there are already thousands and thousands of people, with probably an estimated 8,000.
My goodness. And what's going to happen over 6 days?
Well, this afternoon they'll start a traditional Hmong funeral ceremony, which features the escorting of Vang Pao's spirit to all the places that he's already been in his life, and then to start his journey back through the spirit world until he is reincarnated and comes back to life on Earth.
As far as you know, is there someone who can fill his place now that he is no longer alive?
There's no one person that can fill his place, but there are a lot of very intelligent, well-educated, forward-thinking Hmong leaders in California, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and other parts of the country, Alaska, that can go ahead and provide much-needed leadership for the 21st century.
Now, there was some controversy involving General Vang Pao and others. He spent some time in jail, actually, a couple of years ago, because he was allegedly implicated in a conspiracy plot, although all charges ultimately were cast down. That inspired some hard feelings among the Hmong community.
Excuse me. That case was dropped, as you know.
Yes, that's right. Okay. It sounds like you have a lot going on where you are, Stephen Maganini. So we'll thank you, and I know you've got to get back to your reporting because the funeral is starting.
It is, and thank you for your time. And this is a huge moment in American history as well as Hmong history, because the Hmong did sacrifice their lives to save thousands of American soldiers and engage the North Vietnamese in Thaphat Lao, so the U.S. troops did not have to take on that burden.
Okay, well, thank you so much. I appreciate you joining us at this busy time.
Thank you.
That's Stephen Maganini. He's a Sacramento Bee reporter who's in Fresno covering the 6 day funeral of General Vang Pao, who died last month in Clovis. And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison.